Lines, but very different ways of managing them.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order today is Monday, May 11th, 2015. We're going to go out of order a little bit. The first item, we're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 641A. It will not be moving today because there's some amendments coming, but call Kimberly McCullough, Leonard Williamson, and Gail Meyer, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 641A comes to this committee from Senator Shields, Representative Williamson, Senator Canope, and Representative Huffman. The bill prohibits law enforcement from duplicating or copying data from portable electronic devices without a warrant or consent. It authorizes the court to order law enforcement to purge the duplicated data if certain, if the defendant files a motion for return of property, has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'm Kimberly McCullough, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon, and thank you for having me here today to talk about Senate Bill 641. As you all know, the data that's stored on our cell phones and portable electronic devices can be extremely personal information. It has information on those devices that relates to very, very intimate and personal aspects of our lives, financial information, all sorts of things. And so searches of those types of devices can be particularly intrusive. This bill just deals with a very, very narrow type of search. It's not dealing with all searches of phones, not necessarily dealing with a situation where a phone is seized and somebody's flipping, you know, the officer is flipping through it. But what this specifically narrows in on is the duplication or forensic imaging of what's on your phone. So there are these devices that are now being marketed to law enforcement around the country that can basically, you plug in a phone and it will extract everything from the phone and duplicate it, and that way it can be the data can be mined. That type of a search is particularly intrusive because once all that information has been copied, you can use that to not only access what's on the phone, but access things that have already been deleted, access things that are stored on the cloud, access accounts and things like that remotely. These devices can also crack the passwords of a cell phone. They can decode encrypted data. I think that's about it. So, basically, what this bill would do is it would require a warrant or consent before the data can be duplicated. So the phone could be seized, right? But then they need to get a warrant or consent before they actually do the duplication. You'll note that there is no exception for exigent circumstances, and that's because we believe that there really are no exigent circumstances for completely duplicating the contents of a phone. The phones can be wiped remotely, but law enforcement now have these things called Faraday bags, and you can put the phone inside of it. It basically makes it so that it can't access the internet. So somebody else that's friends with the person whose phone was seized couldn't remotely wipe it. So then they can keep it safe until they actually get that warrant. Just a couple of things to note. Oregon Department of Corrections and Oregon Youth Authority did reach out to us with some concerns that this could interfere with their ability to do things that they're already doing. So when a phone has been discovered in a correctional facility, they certainly are going to want to be able to forensically image that phone and see what was done with it when it's contraband in a facility. Other things that they do is monitoring parolees and folks on probation. So we have met with them and are working on some language to essentially not give them any more authority to do things that they weren't already doing, but also to not limit them from being able to do those things that they are already allowed to do under current law. Did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Kimberly, why can't DOC or OIA already do that? Because if it's a contraband phone, the expectation of privacy in your contraband phone is pretty low.
Right, and I think that the concern there is that this is still going to end up leading to litigation over whether or not a person has an expectation of privacy in a phone that they have in a facility. Yeah, and so, I mean, although I think all of us could probably agree that they shouldn't, that there should be no expectation of privacy, I think that OIA and DOC are anticipating that there might be litigation, and since that's not a privacy interest that the ACLU is worried about protecting, then we figure we may as well put in an exemption for that. But we do need to, you know, work out the specific language and just make sure that that language isn't giving any extra authority.
Can I ask a follow-up on that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you believe, my instinct is probably not, but do you believe that we could, for example, by statute clarify that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in a phone in DOC custody? Basically rendering the litigation moot.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think there's multiple ways that you could skin that cat. You could probably.
I think we could by statute, because reasonable expectation is not a statutory question, as I think of it.
I mean, if there's a constitutional issue,
precisely,
and they're going to sue on the constitutional issue, we're not messing with constitutional law, so certainly whatever we put into law is not going to supersede the Constitution, but yeah. So I suppose there still is the possibility of litigation, if that's what you're getting at.
I see, Mr. Chair, to some degree, I get where you're wanting to go with this bill, but to me it doesn't make sense, because if I want to search a cell phone, whatever, be on the safe side, I'll always get a search warrant.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to me, I'm thinking, I don't know if this policy is really necessary.
Right. Well, our understanding is that there at least have been arguments made that there are exigent circumstances to duplicate a phone in the field. And so we just want to make sure that this is very clear that there aren't.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Discussion of this bill was ongoing as the U.S. Supreme Court was deciding the case of Riley versus California. And then Riley versus California was issued, and it pretty much settled a lot of the law there. Basically, what the Supreme Court said was, these are not normal phones anymore. These are a portal to the entirety of a person's personal privacy data. Basically, you would have to have you could, if you printed out every page of something that was in here, you could have a good 30 trucks of, 4x4 trucks filled to the back with paper. And so what the Supreme Court said is, you really do need a warrant before you can go search the contents of a cell phone, or you need an exception to the warrant requirement. And what was going on in Riley versus California, there were two joint cases. The Supreme Court said that the search incident to arrest exception did not apply in that instance. And Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion, but what he said was, modern cell phones are not just another technological convenience. With all that they contain and all they may reveal, they hold for many Americans, quote, the privacies of life. The fact that technology now allows an individual to carry such information in his hand does not make the information any less worthy of protection for which the founders fought. And so, essentially, Vice Chair Olson, what's happened now is new technologies have been utilized that are now portable and are in officer patrol cars, where essentially before, where they might take a cell phone and just skim it and review it for purposes of text messages and seeing emails or photos or anything like that, they can put it into a device called the Sailbrite. Sailbrite. And I'm sure there's other names now, too. And what it does is it simply extracts the entirety of the hard drive of the phone. So now you're into, your banking and everything else. And so you may have had probable cause in the field and reasonable suspicion or justified use to look at text messages and whatnot. But by putting it into this device in the patrol car and it extracts the image, then you've disgorged the entire contents of the phone that far exceed anything you'd otherwise legitimately be able to view in the field. So actually, as 641 has been amended, this actually is kind of a good, sweet bargain that was entered into between Bronson James, one of our practitioner members, and the Department of Justice. It basically says, for an officer in the field, we're going to leave. This bill does not address an officer in the field picking up a phone and looking at it. So if they want to sit there and look at text messages and take pictures of text messages and they want to view it for Instagrams and photos and emails, they can do whatever they want in the field. That's all going to be adjudicated in a court of law. So the bill is not attempting to even address those, may I use the phrase, exigencies that an officer may encounter in the field. What the bill is intended to do is only to address those instances when there's an effort to extract the forensic image in its entirety. That's what's being limited here, and that's what would require a warrant requirement. I hope that distinction is perhaps clear from what I was saying. We have had a further refinement. We've had discussions with the Department of Justice. On line 20, it uses an exception to the warrant requirement as authorized by appropriate consent. We don't know what the word appropriate consent means, so we've agreed that we would like to request an amendment for lawful consent. As to the amendments being requested by the DOC and by OIA, I was not party to the meeting that had occurred earlier today, but I have had brief conversations here. It is not the intent of the bill to restrict those who engage in supervision or corrections of people who are convicted of crimes. The bill is not intended to address those instances. It's intended to address the instances when there might be an interdiction of the phone outside of those circumstances and require a warrant before the image of the phone or the portable device can be extracted. And getting back, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there really is a need for the bill. I appreciate Representative Olson's comment here that he would not want to ever do this without a warrant, and that's a great instinct. But there is now technologies and devices that allow for the stripping of a forensic image, and this bill comports with the ruling in Riley versus California and says you can't do that absent a warrant. And the one warrant exception that is codified in this bill is lawful consent.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker and committee members. My name is Leonard Williamson. I'm the Inspector General for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And we've talked about Department of Corrections quite a bit already. And what I want to do is draw your attention to two particulars. One, the definition of law enforcement agency, as mentioned in the revised version of the bill, could encompass the Department of Corrections depending on where you go within our statute to look for the definition of a law enforcement agency. Second, technology is now in our prisons, whether we like it or not. Up until 3 or 4 years ago, the way that we monitored inmate mail or phones, mail was paper, and our phones were recorded on a big spool, and we went and listened to those things, and not anymore. It's all completely digital. Inmates have MP3 and MP4 players that they can buy on the canteen with little teeny keyboards, and they can send out emails. Our director received an email from an inmate on death row about 2 years ago with some alarming threats and stuff in it. So our inmates are using email, as well as these other devices. Our vendor for our phone system is about 2 to 3 years out from issuing cell phones to inmates that work on their network and their network alone. Presently, we monitor the electronic mail that comes across these MP3 players. So this current version possibly would prohibit us from looking at or reviewing any of those without getting a warrant. We don't have warrant authority. We can't apply for one. We'd have to get the state police to do that for us. It very much encumber our ability to provide proper security at the institution level. And now cell phone technology is such that they're as big as the fob on my car, and those things are being smuggled in, so we have a problem.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to following up on Representative Olson's points. And admittedly, we deal with it all the time when statutory law and constitutional law blend together. Sometimes that is a more harmonious blending. Search and seizure law, this feels a little awkward. It feels like we're trying to statutorily fix what are
essentially constitutional questions that are dealt with by courts all the time. But given the court's holding in Riley,
isn't the purpose of the effect of this bill would essentially be a statutory floor on exigent circumstances.
Isn't that right? They have to get a warrant anyway. That's the law of the land under the Fourth Amendment, under Riley. However, Riley recognized many exigent circumstance exceptions. This court would, at least in state law, essentially provide a floor above that. Is that, do I understand that right?
I think that you are correct there. And the reason, I mean, if you look at actually at the very end of Riley, there's a command that the Supreme Court stated to the legislatures, which is that the courts are ill-equipped to keep up with the pace of technology and how quickly that changes and how it creates situations where we need to be adjusting the law. And so in Riley, there was this request that legislatures look at evolving technologies and try to put in statutory law some protections for search and seizures. And this particular type of search was not covered by Riley. Riley was essentially just looking at searches generally, mm-hmm. and they said yes, exigent circumstances is one of those circumstances when you can make a search. So that would still apply to that sort of flipping through search, but this more intrusive search, we're saying, mm-hmm. Oregon law would have a little bit of extra protection that you don't. Have codified in or don't have codified in other states necessarily. We don't have it codified here, and the Supreme Court, Oregon or federal, haven't addressed that issue specifically yet.
I can follow up, please. So I find it somewhat humorous that Chief Justice Roberts think we're better positioned to deal with it than he. Admittedly, while it might be the theoretical prerogative of this body to legislate what is and is not acceptable exigent circumstances, there is a reason why we generally don't do that in statute. We leave it up to the courts because it's very fact-specific and it's very consequential if we get it wrong. If we were to make a straight-up bright-line rule here in this body, bright-line rules tend to be over- and under-inclusive. This seems like it could create problems. It also seems like this isn't being done right now, given the holding of Riley. Are there circumstances in Oregon?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, can I tell you exactly the impact of Riley versus California on the ground? I can't say that I can. I can tell you.
I certainly can.
Yeah. Prior to Riley versus California, there was many instances of reports where it may have been relevant to seize a phone, take a look at text messages, but then what was happening is they were taking the phone into the car and extracting the entirety of the hard drive, and he had no idea where that data was going. A couple thoughts, if I can randomly respond to some of the things you're saying. One thing the bill does do is that it broadens this beyond cell phones and describes it, makes it applicable to portable electronic devices, which is, I think, a broad enough definition that it includes the next iteration of whatever it is I'm holding right now. One thing that was going on with Riley, one of the combined cases, was a flip phone that did not have smartphone capacities. But that just shows how far behind the judicial branch will always be in adjudicating and interpreting these technological interfaces with law enforcement. They are always going to be years behind. So one thing this bill intended to do was to broaden it to portable electronic devices. And getting back to your notion of exigency, the way the bill's written is it recognizes that exigency is one of those in-the-field decisions that an officer will make about what can I see, what can't I see. The bill is really limited to the extraction of the image of the hard drive. That must be done with a warrant.
I'm just repeating myself. It seems to me that this bill kind of lost its mojo with Riley. I don't really understand.
Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I heard in earlier testimony that accounts can be accessed, but I didn't hear what kind of accounts, and if they were accessed. And I'm trying to wrap my head around this. I'm hearing, I certainly don't support the idea of putting the proverbial stoplight in after so many bad things have happened, be proactive. But it sounds like this is being maybe extraordinarily proactive when we do have some rulings and some guidance. So do we have some instances where this has really gone south, this has been abused, that we have an issue here that we're trying to resolve that is beyond that of just interpretation? Okay. Specifically, they can access accounts. What accounts, and is that occurring? I mean, do we have instances of police getting into bank accounts of other people?
So by accounts, I mean like any account that you have a password on. So that could be your Facebook account, your email account, all sorts of things like that. And certainly when these devices are duplicated, then they could, when they're doing the forensic mining at a later date or at a later time, you know, they could get into all of those things. Now, can I point to a specific example? I don't have a specific example to give you, but these devices are specifically designed and marketed to do this, and they're marketed to be done in the field. So, like, here you can just get this data really quick and swipe it. And I guess the point about needing to get a warrant is that the time that it takes to go ahead and download all of that information, which that only takes about 4 or 5 minutes, but then the time that it takes to then do the forensic analysis and actually dig through all of that data, that takes a while. And so the fact that that takes a while, it kind of defeats the whole purpose of an exigency, right? Exigency is like, we've got some missing person or something that happened and I need to get in the phone and look really quick and see if I can find something out to tell someone. But the data mining and analysis, that's something that takes time, and it's so much more intrusive, and so much it can tell you so much more about a person. So I appreciate your desire to know, is there some specific instances I can give you? I certainly do know that these devices are being used in the field to extract data. I know that's because that's what they're being marketed for, and they're being acquired by law enforcement. And my concern would be that once law enforcement has access to that treasure trove of data, I think that it's important that before that treasure trove of data gets turned over, that there be some sort of court supervision or consent. Particularly because I just don't think that there is any exigent circumstances. And this is something we discussed with our work group, which was pretty broad. And we all reached agreement on that, I believe.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm a little embarrassed to admit when I was doing this work, I didn't wrestle much with the cell phone issue. That said, whether it's a cell phone or it's a car, or it's a wallet, or it's a garage, or it's whatever. There was always this thought process, and I have a feeling it hasn't changed, that goes through a cop's mind, which is, I do have the right to access this. I know that based on training and experience. Mm-hmm. I don't have the right to access this. Mm-hmm. I know this because based on my training and experience. And this gray area here, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But where I'm going with this information is so valuable, I don't want to compromise the outcome by my path mm-hmm. to get there. So I'm going to err on the side of caution. Mm-hmm. What's changed?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, devices like the Cellbright. That's what's changed.
That doesn't, follow up, Mr. Chair, that doesn't change the thinking. That doesn't change that paradigm. That lends another tool, maybe makes it easier if you choose to go that direction. But you're not going to get a conviction if you have compromised the process and compromised that evidence. Cops know that.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I would agree, but I would say that from the accounts that I've heard from my end of membership is countless times, and I will acknowledge this might be prior to Riley, The phone may have been relevant in the field for the purposes of checking out text messages and whatnot, but it went into the car and it was copied, and it was like, you can have your phone back now. Your question is, what happened to the data? What did they do to the data? It's one of those instances where you don't know what you don't know, but the government now has a whole lot of data. And this is what the United States Supreme Court has said is, this is not your normal device anymore. It just isn't. What you hold in your wallet pales in comparison to what's inside the phone. And so phones are different. And can I tell you that most law enforcement in the field were you getting a warrant before they used the Cellbrite? No, they weren't. They weren't.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm not sure whether my question is to the witnesses or the counsel. I'm intrigued with the last clause, sub 3 under section 3, which says specifically that when a request for the data has been granted by the court, that the law enforcement agency cannot keep copies of the data that they have. Is that similar to what would happen with physical evidence as well? Mm-hmm. With documents of other kind?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, yes. If, let's say that there had been an improper search of the computer or seizure of a computer, and you did a motion for return or restoration of things seized, and the court was to make a determination the seizure of the computer was wrong, then one of the remedies the court would say is disgorge everything you ever got out of that computer if you made physical copies, whatnot.
It would always say that? This is specific, that it says it always is the case.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I think that this is written that says it, if it's an order granting a motion, then it shall include a provision that it may not retain a copy of the raw data. Right.
Yeah, the intention of that was to just mirror what's happening with other types, if it was a journal or something else.
I assume that.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Pardon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. I'm sorry for the tough questioning. This is, but I think I've had the opportunity to clarify my thoughts a bit. I think there is a logical flaw at the heart of this bill. So, given Riley, which stands for the proposition that you need a Riley, you need a warrant unless there are exigent circumstances. That's settled law. Great. If there are no exigent circumstances to justify this kind of forensic imaging, as you testified, and I don't disagree with you, I can't think of any off the top of my head. If that is the case, then this bill is not necessary because the warrant requirement in Riley exists. If, however, there are exigent circumstances that we can't think about, then this bill is essentially limiting law enforcement, legitimate law enforcement activities in ways we can't anticipate. So it's one or the other. One, either it doesn't do any good, it's neither here nor there, or it actually is doing something, we just don't know what it is.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, so I beg to differ, and that would because there's certain circumstances where there may be exigent circumstances to search the phone, but not exigent circumstances to duplicate the phone. And the problem now is that as soon as there's exigent circumstances to search the phone, yeah, right, then officers are taking those phones and also duplicating them. And so this clarifies that, look, you can seize the phone, you can search the phone, you can't duplicate the phone. You can stick it in a Faraday bag, get a court order or a warrant, and then do all of that forensic imaging and so on. But then you're going to have to go to court and say, look, we really need to be able to data mine this, which is super intrusive.
Got it.
And you know, if we could think of some exigent circumstances that would justify something that takes time to do, right? It takes time to do this. And so the idea of exigency has to do with time, and this takes time. So it seems somewhat counterintuitive to think that there would be exigent circumstances to do something that takes the same time that it takes to get a warrant. So yeah, if we could think of a circumstance, I would be delighted to amend it to exclude that. But I just don't think that actually exists. And the problem is that if we don't pass this law, I believe that there are officers who will think, I have exigent circumstances to search this phone, I'm going to go ahead
therefore
and duplicate it.
Image. See, that's the thing. You see, that argument you just made,
yeah,
I think is a pretty good one, and I think it also applies in court. I think Riley would protect this kind of data.
Chair Barker, if I might, and Representative Barton, I think part of the problem is it's not always clear to the defendant whether or not they've extracted the data from the phone. I mean, they may be handcuffed against the wall, whatnot. They don't really know what's going on with their phone behind their backs. So that's number one. But number two, I forgot my point. It was a good one, though. It really was.
Governor Perry.
So, yeah.
Representative Springer again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me be ultra clear here. I don't support the government having access to just download everything on your phone and to dump that data and then to mine through it and decide what they want to do with it. I don't know that that's really at the heart of what we're talking about here. That's certainly maybe a piece of it that's being brought in. I would love to hear, if this bill's moving forward, Mr. Chair, I would love to hear from law enforcement what they're doing. If they are seizing a phone incident to arrest and dumping all the data off of it and then putting it in evidence or something to see what they want to do with it next, I'd like to know what the policies are out there. This is a new area to me. How law enforcement is actually dealing with this, and if we have some incidents of complaints where law enforcement's just dumped everything off a phone to see what they want to see.
Just really curious. Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Gail, you mentioned Cell Bright was one. I see Deadbolt is another one that's out there right now. Do you have any idea what the cost of those are?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Orsland, I don't.
Okay.
Further questions, Representative Post?
Thank you. I want to actually get credit for actually reading a entire, whatever you call those things,
opinion
case. We've been,
did oh, you read?
I
yeah.
actually read it this afternoon. Yeah, I really have no life. And
Wilson's rubbing off on you.
But the point is, I read it, and so I'm having this sort of the same sort of things that are going through my head. Of is okay, that seems to cover it. So I'm still not completely sold. But I want to ask this. Did the Riley case and or this bill, are we also talking about, and maybe I'm just talking a different language here, cloning?
Yeah.
Is that what we're talking
yeah.
about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cloning.
Okay, because you know, it's one thing to just extract a hard drive. There's another to actually clone the phone, and then I can actually use, you know, if I do this to Representative Langer's phone, have it close enough, I can actually now hear her phone for the rest of however long I want.
Oh.
Is it addressing that? Because that's actually the greater fear to me than anything, and I didn't see that addressed. And cloning is actually huge now. I'm kind of a geek.
I don't know that I actually know about cloning, so
cloning
now
awesome.
I have something to research.
eBay. I can sit it next to her phone, and with the right button, I can press it, and I can now listen to her every conversation, her text. I can't access her information, her hard drive, but I can listen to everything that she's ever done.
I'd be astonished that didn't require a warrant.
Chair Barker, Representative Post, I don't think cloning is included in... What was that?
Okay.
I don't think cloning, as you've described it, is included in the bill because it's talking here about forensic imaging, which means using an electronic device to download or transfer raw data from a portable electronic device onto another medium of digital storage. So I'm not so sure it would address cloning.
Yeah.
Well, that's a fear I have.
Further? Nothing further. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Taylor, Chris Winters, and Ryan.
Mr. Chair, can I ask counsel to share what he just told me?
Yeah.
I hope they're coming.
I love how you always do. They're going to stop talking.
Well, because we start talking, then I'm like, well, you should say that out loud.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I was saying that oftentimes these situations don't come up in terms of a judicial remedy because a criminal case isn't filed where someone would be seeking suppression and constitutional limitations would be before the court. In terms of the work group that went into this bill, this is a general prohibition. It isn't specific to a criminal case being filed. And so what I was sharing with Representative Boyce is a lot of times this information could be out there, but there'd be no case filed where there would be a judicial remedy where the court would be analyzing exigent circumstances versus not exigent circumstances.
Mr. Chair and Counsel, isn't that true of, I mean, any Fourth Amendment liberty? I mean, that's, I guess, isn't that equally true of things that unquestionably need a warrant? Say, I mean, planting bugs in somebody's bedroom. I'm trying to think of like the most egregious violation of the Fourth Amendment possible. To the extent there's no criminal case filed, there's also no remedy. I mean, that's just exclusionary rules, kind of what we got, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Whoever wants to go first.
I'll go just first. If that's okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Lufkin. I'm a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County. I'm a member of the Law Enforcement Responsibility Technologies Group. And Kevin Campbell told me I'm also here on behalf of the Chief of Police. I was in the work group that helped negotiate this bill, and I think it's a very positive step forward to what the proponents were looking to accomplish. But I think the questions that you all have discussed have illuminated the one issue that we still have left with this bill and would like to see addressed, if possible, in this session or in the next session if it's not possible, which is the concept of exigency. So I'd like to try and touch on some of the points that were raised and hopefully illuminate some of more information from the ground level. I've done thousands of these cases and hundreds of warrants for phones. I teach our office on search and seizure. I teach the police bureau on search and seizure. So I have a fair accounting of what actually happens in the field. And what I'd like to start with is the premise that there are no exigent circumstances that could ever justify forensically imaging a phone. I agree they're rare, and that's because exigent circumstances are, by their nature, rare. But there are a few cases, including one Court of Appeals opinion I read just today from last year, that help illuminate this point, which is, in this particular case I'm thinking of, a youth offender was arrested for probable cause that he was in possession of child pornography. And what he had done is, before his arrest, he had given his hard drive over to his buddy. And when he was arrested, he called his buddy to destroy the contents of the hard drive. The officers arrived on the scene and found the hard drive plugged in and ready to be destroyed. So they immediately took the hard drive with exigency. Other examples more pertaining to cell phones, I've prosecuted two different cases, one where there's a large drug trafficking organization. These trafficking organizations constantly contact their runners every 10 to 15 minutes by cell phone to check in on them. If the runner does not respond, it's assumed that he's arrested, and so the entire network starts to destroy its evidence and cell phones. The runner in question, who was in the car when the police officers arrested him, was furiously destroying the evidence on his phone, deleting contacts and the like. So the officer was able to seize that phone pursuant to exigency and download it. And then finally, I had another case where a person suspected of abusing their child was using their cell phone in the middle of their interview. And when he became confronted with the idea that there was evidence on his phone that could corroborate or disprove the child abuse allegations, he was under the table destroying it as best he could before the officer seized it. Now, the presumption from the advocates of the bill was that there's no reason why the officers couldn't throw that phone in a Faraday bag and then write a search warrant. That is simply not true. The newer versions of cell phones that are out there, including all of the iPhone 6s, are encrypted. And as soon as the phone locks, which is to turn off for even a fraction of a second or go back to its lock screen, you are not capable of accessing that phone any further. And technology to break that encryption is sometimes years behind the technology to actually encrypt. So the moment in time that the officer has to obtain an image or really any evidence of that phone is in that moment of time before the phone is able to shut off. Some phones are set to shut down in as little as 10 or 15 or 30 seconds. It's not rational that an officer would have to stay there playing with the phone for hours on end while his confederate writes a search warrant. That is not a very practical solution to the problem. When we were in the work group and this, these examples were posed to the proponents, they just simply weren't either believing or accepting that this is something that we should craft an exception around. I would like to propose to you that there's a very easy workaround to this problem, because we do believe from law enforcement's perspective that the purposes behind this bill are noble and good ones. We don't have a problem with getting search warrants in the vast majority of these cases. Representative Springer is completely correct. No officer would like to rely on exigency to prove their murder case when a cell phone search has occurred. That is an extraordinarily risky way of accomplishing something. So these circumstances are very rare. The solution that we had in mind was a fairly simple one. If exigency is relied on to do a forensic imaging, no review of that data would occur before a search warrant was obtained, meaning the exigency in actually obtaining the data and preserving it has been completely accomplished by the downloading process. But the privacy right that the defendant would have in that data has not been truly infringed upon because no review of that data has been conducted. A search warrant at that point would be a reasonable step because the data has been preserved. I think that's still the correct way to balance this issue in a statute so that we aren't, to Representative Barton's point of view, not going into realms that we're not exactly familiar with. These are just case examples that I've run into. Undoubtedly, there are more. There are potentially more dangerous examples with child abduction cases. So I wouldn't want to take exigency completely off the table, nor did the Supreme Court, which affirmatively stated that exigency was a valid constitutional principle in the Riley case. So I'm hopeful that we could address that issue, but I don't want the detail to overcome the benefit of the rest of this bill. I think particularly clarifying that you can do a motion for return of things seized so that you can have a remedy outside the criminal process, so that you could have the ability to bring this issue in front of a court before your case settled. Law enforcement is required, essentially under good practices for evidence reasons, to download a complete forensic image of your device. That is the one and only way we can prove that the material was actually obtained from your device and not fabricated by police, is by showing a digital fingerprint between the two identical copies. So we're essentially required to take in a tremendous amount of evidence. But if the defendant moves the court to limit, to narrow that scope of data that's been seized down, he is essentially relinquishing that right to challenge that they're identical copies anymore. And so that's why the motion for return of things seized was a really good venue to address that issue, because it is a lot of data that law enforcement is taking, and we're cognizant of the privacy rights in that data. I think to Representative Olson's question about whether or not this bill is necessary, I mean, the Riley case is what it is. We are currently instructing at least the Portland Police Bureau that they cannot, absent exigency, search a phone or download a phone. That is what Riley says, and that is how we are following it. Almost all cases are processed by search warrants now. Certainly in the past, they were done under the search incident to arrest principles far more frequently. Happy to concede that, but Riley has completely foreclosed that. We are not able to use that route anymore. So to the extent that it's necessary, it has helpful points in it that guide us, especially around the motion for return of things seized. I think that's a good part of the bill. But I would urge the folks to really think about the exigency issue and see if that isn't something that could be addressed here, because I just think that there's a disconnect between some of the proponents and what's actually going on in the field. The solutions that are in mind really don't really comport with what is actually happening. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions about the bill.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Scott Taylor. I'm the director of the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors today. We believe Senate Bill 641A in its current form is opposed by OACCD because of the impact it will have on our ability to supervise individuals as ordered by the courts and the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Specifically, this bill applies to law enforcement agencies. Community corrections is included in this designation. The provisions in this bill prohibit a law enforcement agent from obtaining data from a portable electronic device without a warrant or consent. The provisions in this bill do not specifically recognize community corrections conditions of supervision. On a daily basis, we supervise 32,000 convicted felon offenders in the communities across the state. Many of these individuals have conditions of supervision that allow us to search their phones, computers, readers, and other digital equipment. Given the population we supervise, the ability to hold them accountable is a key factor in promoting community safety and offender behavior change. passage of Senate Bill 641A would result in limiting the ability of community corrections to utilize an important tool in holding offenders accountable. Specifically, this bill would limit the ability of our officers to search the items, such as phones and computers, per conditions of supervision. The ability to do these searches can result in discovering behavior that violates probation, parole conditions, and occasionally new criminal activity. This ability is particularly valuable when we work with sex offenders, domestic violence abusers, drug dealers, human traffickers, and gang members whose activities are often done in a secretive style and often unable to be monitored without forensics. This bill could limit our ability to track the activities of predatory offenders whose conditions of supervision include searches of electronic devices. Another concern is the broad definition of electronic devices proposed in this bill. Currently, we use GPS tracking and electronic alcohol monitoring as a way to monitor a selection of offenders. Given the current wording, we are uncertain whether our ability to do so would be limited. OACCD requests the bill be amended to allow for the exemption of probation and parole from the restrictions placed on law enforcement. And in addition, this bill limiting probation and parole officers has a huge impact on important statewide resource. Our department runs a computer forensic lab that allows us to monitor the digital behavior of people on supervision to promote victim and community safety. The forensic lab is a key component in our community supervision of the 21st century. Our lab supports community corrections throughout Oregon and works in collaboration with the Northwest Regional Computer Forensic Laboratory and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And Christy's going to talk more specifically about the lab and the effects of this bill on that. And we would say that we were in the meeting before this hearing, and we believe that the concerns we had are being addressed.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christy Winters, and I am a probation and parole officer and a computer forensics examiner with the Department of Community Justice Computer Forensics Lab at Multnomah County. My goal in testifying today is to share some concerns that we have regarding the current version of Senate Bill 641A. So we all know, we all live in the age of technology, where essentially everyone interacts with electronic devices on a daily basis. This applies to people who are supervised by community corrections agencies as well. At Multnomah County, we have a fully operational computer forensics lab that provides critical forensic support to community justice agencies throughout the state of Oregon. The goal of our lab is to provide forensic services for probation and parole officers to make evidence-based best practices decisions regarding offender supervision in the interest of positive behavioral changes and public safety. Lab operations are intended to provide information to officers regarding electronic data that remains hidden deep within the digital world of cyberspace, which are only discovered through computer forensics analysis. One of the essential duties of probation and parole officers is to monitor and enforce the conditions of supervision that are ordered by the court and by the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. These conditions are based on the likelihood to reoffend and on criminal histories, which increasingly involve the use of electronic devices. As a result, supervision orders often direct reasonable searches of electronic equipment, which include portable electronic devices by our officers, as a way to evaluate supervision compliance, protect the safety of victims, and promote overall community safety. This bill specifically refers to a law enforcement agency, and Oregon administrative rules designate probation and parole officers as law enforcement officers. The provisions in this bill prohibit a law enforcement agency from obtaining data from a portable electronic device without consent or a search warrant. This bill does not take into account supervision conditions that call for searches of electronic devices that are based on reasonable grounds that evidence of a violation will be found. Definitions in Senate Bill 641A encompass virtually all types of computers and other electronic devices. This bill's impact may seriously jeopardize community corrections' public safety mission and our ability to apply best practice supervision by severely limiting our ability to forensically examine a vast array of electronic devices. These devices are not just cell phones under this bill, but it's also iPads, iPods, electronic readers, gaming consoles, GPS devices, USB flash drives, laptop computers, and the list goes on and on. Senate Bill 641A allows for the search of electronic data that is observable from the portable electronic device by normal, unaided human senses. This type of search violates a key premise of forensic science regarding data preservation because it will make changes to digital evidence, especially key file dates and times. As a result, it increases the risk that digital evidence may be ruled inadmissible in judicial proceedings. Furthermore, because of the way electronic devices store data, files are easily hidden from direct view and require computer forensics analysis to uncover the facts. The provisions in this bill that prohibits a law enforcement agency from retaining copies of the raw data to be returned runs diametrically opposed to best practice forensic standards. Like other scientific forensics lab, we retain extracted data from electronic devices for a defined period of time in a secure manner for future appeals. The bill mandates the return of equipment and extracted raw data with no regard for the digital contents. This provision is especially concerning because it includes digital evidence that is identified by treatment providers as harmful to victims and the community, or violates conditions of supervision and or state and federal laws, as is the case with child pornography. For example, with cases involving dangerous child sex offenders who have histories of possessing child pornography on portable electronic devices, this bill would prohibit our ability to examine the contents of these devices because this bill does not take into account conditions of supervision that direct the search of electronic devices. In summary, I respectfully request that you consider amending this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I will take any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
In aid of a question I asked earlier, did I hear you say that even if you received a court order requiring you to return evidence, that you would keep copies of it?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, we have not had that situation in the past. What we do is a standard forensic process is that whenever we do an extraction, we will keep that electronic data for, right now it's an average of like 5 years, for appeals that might happen during that time.
Even if you received a court order ordering you to return that data?
Yes, sir. Since we've not had that, it's hard for me to testify that we do that, but if we were to do that, the only issue would be if it contains child pornography, and to return that would be a violation of federal law.
I think, Chair Barker, Representative Gernick, I think whenever we receive a court order ordering us to do something, we would do that.
Well, the court order would order you to return something. It wouldn't order you not to keep a copy of it.
So we would return the product or the whatever the order ordered us to give back. We would have a digital copy, and that would be up to the court to order us to return that or not, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, Mr. Taylor, let me ask you, so as a condition of parole, I'm on parole, and so part of you tell me you have to agree to be searched at any time.
Yes.
So it's kind of like, how would that be different than the electronic search that you need to do or you feel you need to do in order to have your clients?
Yeah, a lot of it fits within the parameters of how we operate today. What we're concerned about is examples of where you refuse to give me that phone. Now you're in violation of probation. Now we end up in a court process, and that escalates everything dramatically. And that's the difference. We don't ask for a warrant. We just take you into custody and go to court.
Okay. But so as far as the Fourth Amendment, though, I give up my right to not be searched while I'm on parole, so it seemed like my phone could be part of that as well.
And we are now receiving specific orders from courts telling people that they're giving up that right, and I think this bill puts us in a confusing state.
It certainly does. Okay. Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. That was helpful. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on
it took an hour.
Bill 641A. And 3, 6, 4. Open a Public hearing on Senate Bill 364.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 364A comes to this committee from the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. It has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. The bill requires the court to consider the current classification of marijuana offenses in order to determine whether a conviction is eligible to be expunged. It also reinstates a former provision of Oregon law that permits marijuana offenses to be reduced to misdemeanors. It declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. It's ready to move.
Thank you. And it is Bill 364A. Gail Meyer, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Last week there was a little moment where Representative Barton, you were saying you were, watch out for your relating to clause because you were never going
relating
to crime. So this is a technical fix of a technical fix that went wrong. In 2013, I had a bill and it related to marijuana, and that's my story. I will never again lobby a bill relating to marijuana. So in 2013, we had a technical fix that had no opposition at the time. It was pretty simple. There was an anomaly or a dichotomy in our criminal code. Some parts of our criminal code had marijuana crimes calibrated as though they were Schedule I controlled substances. Other crimes had them calibrated as though they were Schedule II substances, and there was a disparity between those. So we wanted to correct that. Marijuana has been designated as a Schedule II drug by the Oregon's Board of Pharmacy. So in 2013, we only wanted to do one thing, is to take those crimes in our criminal code that had it calibrated as a Schedule one drug and move it down to being a Schedule II drug. And so that was important for purposes of making people with older convictions expungement eligible. It put the A felonies down to Class B and the B felonies down to Class C. And that was important for making them expungement eligible. As we originally introduced the bill in 2013, all was good. Nobody opposed the bill. But then it started to attract other attention from other sources, and it did a lot to the bill. And it created misdemeanor possession crimes, and it eliminated B felony possession and just went with C felony possession and misdemeanors and all that stuff, and the whole bill got all wrapped up. In net effect, what happened was the entire bill was made prospective for conduct occurring on or after the effective date of the act, which was July 1, 2013. And we missed that. We didn't catch that. But that didn't comport with our intent. Our intent was we wanted people with older convictions to be eligible to have their convictions set aside. So fix number one of the technical fix. So the technical fix is in Section 1. And it simply clarifies that when a person is convicted of a marijuana offense based on conduct occurring before July 1, 2013, the court shall consider the offense classification level as if the conduct occurred on July 1, 2013. It reads that way in order to make clear that Measure 91 has no impact on this. So Measure 91 came along and decriminalized certain conduct, but that's, we're not attempting to get a free pass based on that. So that's Section 1. Second problem that happened, again, when the 2013 bill attracted attention from others, it eliminated the crime of B felony possession of marijuana and created only C felonies and misdemeanors. And so in doing that, it removed from a statute, ORS 161705, any reference to the conviction of B felony possession of marijuana. That's the statute at issue in Section 2 here. That's a great little statute. What that statute does is it allows a court the authority to declare a case to be a misdemeanor, even though it is a felony. So usually it applies to C felonies. But it did say that if you were convicted of a B felony possession of marijuana, the court would have the authority at least to entertain reducing that to a misdemeanor. The 2013 bill, though, because it eliminated the B felony, stripped that language out of that statute. And belatedly, after the fact, we realized we really need it in there because some people are not eligible for a set-aside or expungement, but they would be eligible to have that thing declared a misdemeanor. So all this bill does is reinsert that language into Section 2. So the net effect of both of these changes are they're technical fixes to comport with our original intent of our original bill before amended. And again, the district attorneys had no objection to our original bill in 2013. They understand what went wrong. They understand how we're trying to fix it. They have no opposition to the bill now.
Any questions?
Do you think you got it right?
I have asked for about 10 set of eyes on this one. I sure hope so. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 364A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 364A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Williamson moves Senate Bill 364A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Post.
I had several amendments that I wanted to add to this.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Carrier?
I'd be happy to.
Representative Leininger. Carrier. Open a work session on Senate Bill 188A.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 188A comes to this committee from the Office of the Attorney General. We had a previous public hearing on this bill on April 29th. The bill creates the crime of the unlawful dissemination of an intimate image and prohibits the non-consensual disclosure of an intimate picture to a website with a specific intent to harass, humiliate, or injure another person. We have several amendments before the committee. The proposed Dash 5 amendments do two things. One, it clarifies that the immunity given to interactive computer services is parallel to that under federal law. And secondly, it adds an emergency clause. The bill is ready to move with the Dash 5 amendments. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Can you see again what the Dash 5 does?
The Dash 5 adds an emergency clause. And secondly, there is federal immunity given to interactive computer services for the content put on those websites by another. And playing with the language with folks on that, we wanted to make sure we got it right and linked it to the specific federal statute so we weren't giving any broader immunity. It just matches the existing immunity under federal law.
Thank you. Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was this or was this not the upskirting bill? It's not, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This was another, this was the revenge porn bill.
Had a few this year. Representative Post.
Okay, and thank you. Just a quick question, maybe again for counsel. I have, maybe I'm missing something, but I have never heard interactive computer service. I've heard ISP. I've heard content provider. This one's a new one to me, interactive computer service.
So, Chair Barker, Representative Post, the best way I can describe this is a bulletin board. The physical bulletin board that anyone can post something onto. The federal definition of interactive computer service is like a website whereby others, without you, can just post stuff onto that website. This term comes out of a federal statute. Oh. It was addressed at the last hearing, the Federal Communications Decency Act. It's a term of art from federal law.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments into Senate Bill 188A.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 5 amendments into Senate Bill 188A. Discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 188A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 188A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Again, any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Williams, carry first, please. Any further business?
She likes those porno bills. Yeah.
We stand adjourned. Thank you. We stand adjourned. Thank you.
She likes those porno bills. Yeah.